This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Animal Week series continues with the stories of a polar bear stranded at sea because of global warming and an elephant lost in a sandstorm. They're two scenes of animals in the wild from the movie Earth. It was shot in 200 different locations in 64 countries, from the tops of mountains to the bottom of the ocean. Technological innovations in aviation and camera equipment made it possible for the filmmakers to capture scenes of animal life we have not witnessed before. Earlier this year, I spoke with the two directors of Earth, Alastair Fothergill and Mark Linfield. They also collaborated on the TV series Planet Earth. They've both directed nature programs for the BBC. Fothergill is the former head of the BBC's Natural History Unit. Alastair Fothergill, Mark Linfield, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the movie. You have cameras in amazing places. For example, in the beginning of the film, we see the polar bears just at the end of their hibernation, just as the sun has returned to the North Pole. And the polar bears are emerging from underneath the ice to see the sun again. How did you know when and where to have the cameras so you could actually see that moment when the polar bears come out of hibernation?
Well, if you really know your polar bears, then there are certain telltale signs that give away the presence of a den. And in the case of these polar bears that were filmed in Kong Kala's land in northern Norway, or part of an archipelago off northern Norway, there's a tiny little dimple in the snow on a slope, with a slope having exactly the right degree of slopiness. And if you know what you're looking for, that is an absolute telltale sign. Now, what the crew had to do was stake out that likely den site and wait and wait and wait and hope that they were correct. And of course, after a couple of weeks of waiting in extremely cold temperatures, the mother finally poked her nose out of the den. So, you know, great field craft, really.
You don't only have to wait. You have to wait there with the camera rolling on a piece of ice. I mean, you know, the camera's focused just on this ice, waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the bears to come out, hoping that it's focused on the right piece of ice at the right moment with the camera on when the bear emerges.
Well, what's lucky is that the mother polar bear will stick her nose out, sniff around, put her nose back down, and then stick it out again.
Uh-huh. So you do like a dress rehearsal.
So you get a couple of moments in which to switch the camera off, because you're right, of course, if you were literally running the camera for 2 weeks, you'd run out of tapes and batteries.
It's a magnificent sight to see the polar bears emerge, like, you know, the adults and the little children, the little cubs. Can you just describe what it looks like?
It's a very special moment, really, because, and the reason we've spent so much time waiting for that very special moment is that they've been born underneath the ice. The mother makes her den in October, November, the end of the autumn, gives birth in this den. And, you know, when they emerge in March, the cubs are about 2 months old. And they literally, they come out and their eyes are blinking with the first bright sunlight of the Arctic spring, and they're very nervous. You know, it's nice and warm and snug inside that den, and, you know, it's minus 35. It's very, very cold in March, and the mother is desperately hungry. She hasn't eaten for 5 months since she went into that den, and she's very keen to get out onto the sea ice to hunt for seals. She's lost half her body weight, but the cubs, they don't want to go anywhere. You know, they've got mum's milk. They like staying in the den, and they play around on the slope, and it's a wonderfully intimate time. But eventually, mother says, come on, come on, you're not going to get any milk if you follow me. And after about 10 days of hanging around the den entrance, she persuades her two cubs out onto the sea ice, which is a dangerous and frightening world for her, but also for her cubs.
You follow the father bear, the father polar bear of this family, as he sets out on the ice to find food, which means seals. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, and we've been hearing a lot about this, that with global warming, the ice is melting, the ice sheet is melting, and we see that illustrated before our eyes with this polar bear who, well, why don't you describe, Alastair, what happens to the polar bear?
Well, what's interesting about the polar bears is they get about 90% of their food in a very, very limited window of time. And this is the time in the spring when the sea ice has still not melted away and the seals are all giving birth to their pups. Now, seals, because they're air-breathing mammals, have to come to holes in the ice, breathing holes, and that is where, for a very short period, the polar bears can grab the seals. As soon as the sea ice breaks up, as soon as the seal pups can have the strength and the age to swim away, it's very hard for the polar bears to catch their food. And increasingly, what's happening with global warming is that that winter sea ice is breaking up earlier and earlier, and that window of opportunity, that limited time when they can hunt for their food, is getting shorter and shorter. And, you know, literally, the world that they live in, the ice that they walk on, is melting beneath their feet. And, you know, we think that if sea ice in the Arctic reduces at its present rate, it's quite likely that the polar bear may be pretty well extinct in the wild by 2030, 2040. This is an animal that isn't really hunted by anybody, that lives in a wilderness area which is, you know, undisturbed by human populations. It should be an animal that should be really thriving. And in many ways, until recently, it was. But now, because of global warming, it's in real danger.
And it's such a magnificent animal. Why don't you describe the peril that this father polar bear runs into in its quest to find seals, to find food for its family?
Well, the last thing it does in the summer, one of the magic moments for me, and I was filming this actually, was I was in a helicopter high up filming the male polar bear swimming out in the open ocean. And this is a world where traditionally we've never been able to film before because, you know, you can't walk out there. There's no ice to walk on. You can't bring in an icebreaker because you disturb the polar bear. But I was up there in a helicopter looking down, and this beautiful bear, you know, the world's largest land carnivore, was swimming, diving down. The water was crystal clear. You could see it swimming underwater. It looked beautiful, but, you know, it's a problem. You know, polar bears are not designed for long periods of swimming. And finally, our male polar bear had to resort to attacking a colony of walrus. When the ice melts, walrus hole out in large groups. And it's a desperate technique for polar bears because adult walrus are very big, much bigger than their normal prey. And, of course, they're armed with those very impressive tusks. And our actual male was stabbed by a walrus in its attempts to try and steal one of its pups and actually died. And it's a very strong and powerful moment in the film, I think.
You know, you were filming something that I'm not sure people have seen before, which is a polar bear swimming in the ocean looking for food. And you have this incredible view of it. So exactly where are you poised in this helicopter? How far are you, and what kind of equipment do you have that enables you to see in adequate detail what the polar bear is doing?
Well, what's amazing is we're basically a mile away from that bear. And this was a remarkable new camera system called the Cineflex. And what it effectively does is it carries a camera beneath the helicopter, but very importantly and very sort of in breakthrough, really, the lens on that camera is far more powerful than any lens that we have been able to stabilize on a helicopter before. And that means you can be a mile away from the animal you're trying to film and yet still get the close-ups you want without in any way disturbing the animals. So the male polar bear had no idea that we were there. And we used it many times. We used it to film a wolf hunt from the air. Again, wolves are very shy animals, but we were able to film for the first time a complete wolf hunt in that way. We used it to follow our humpback whale mother and her calf through rough ocean waters where you'd never be able to keep up in a boat. And it was it was one of the most important breakthroughs for this movie, both in filming behavior, but also in delivering wonderful cinematographic wide-angle images of the scenery of our planet.
You know, I'm thinking when the polar bear was swimming looking for land and for food, you had a much more expansive view than the polar bear did, and you could see basically what he was in store for, that he wasn't going to find land, and he wasn't going to find a place where he could get at seals. What did it feel like knowing basically that the polar bear was doomed, which the polar bear didn't know?
Many people ask us that question, you know, why don't you get involved? Why don't you You know, some people say, why don't you shoot a walrus to feed the polar bear? You know, when you get into these situations where you see animals having a really hard time, can't you intervene? And of course, for us, the first rule of wildlife filmmaking really is never disturb, never intervene. It's not our role. I mean, it's impractical, to be honest. I mean, how you can't go on shooting walruses for polar bears, even if you'd want to. And, you know, it's a moral issue. We just need to observe and show people nature as it is, both, you know, the gentle side of nature and also the more tough and rough side of nature as well.
Well, also, I mean, say you were doing the film on the walruses, you know, then you'd be really upset that the polar bear was coming to kill the walrus.
I think the thing is to put everything in the context, you know. I mean, you know, a walrus has its pups. The polar bear is starving. We have a very powerful sequence of a cheetah catching a gazelle, and you have to remember that, of course, that cheetah has cubs to feed, and that's the whole point about nature. You need to. I think we were very, very keen to show it in its trueness, true nature. And there are some harder scenes that need to be to give a true picture of the natural world.
My guests are Alistair Fothergill and Mark Linfield, directors of the film Earth. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about filming animals in the wild. My guests, Alistair Fothergill and Mark Linfield, directed the movie Earth, which followed animal families in 64 countries in search of food. Mark Linfield, you worked very closely on this sequence about the elephant migration to get during the dry season to water. Describe a little bit what the elephants are up against in this migration.
Yes, well, the elephants migrating across the Kalahari in southern Africa, which is where we filmed them, have to undertake really quite an epic migration, as you say, driven by ultimately by thirst, but also hunger. And it's a journey that takes them through extremely inhospitable lands. And I think that's best illustrated in the movie by an occasion where they're crossing a particularly barren stretch of ground, effectively desert, really sand. And we were filming them from a helicopter. And I recall the day when we looked on the horizon, and there was just this wall of dust heading towards them. And basically out of nowhere, a sandstorm had blown up, and the elephants had no idea what was coming. From our high vantage point in the sky, we could see what they were about to face. And these elephants just disappeared into the sandstorm, and from way above, it was just an incredible view unfolding beneath us of these mother elephants trying to nurse their calves, trying to push them through the worst of the storm, trying to keep motivating, trying to keep them going. And the whole herd were just sort of hunkering down and pulling together. And despite this, despite the fact that all the elephants were pulling together and the mothers were trying to take good care of their calves, I remember when the storm cleared, there was an incredibly sad scene of this one little elephant walking off into the distance, and it thought that it was just fallen slightly behind, and it was trying to walk faster and faster to catch up with its mother. And from where we were in the sky, we could see that it was actually heading in exactly the wrong direction, and we could see right out into the open that basically it was heading off into the middle of nowhere. And I think that was one of the moments for me where you really sense this idea of the animals battling the elements on our planet, and just a great sense of wilderness. And it was something that really we've only been able to capture recently because of advances in technology and the ability to film animal behaviour from the air. I mean, these sorts of scenes just a few years ago would have been impossible to film.
There's a lot of animal showdowns in the film, and one of them is during the elephant migration sequence when, you know, the elephants, they're hungry, they're thirsty. You can see they've lost a lot of their body weight because you're starting to see, like, bones sticking out. And then they're attacked by some lions. And could you describe where you and the film crew were while shooting this confrontation?
Yes, the film crew, led by a great camera woman called Justine Evans, had staked out a waterhole. And, of course, that's exactly what the lions were doing too. The lions knew that the elephants were going to come to this waterhole. And very unusually for lions, this extremely large group are specialist elephant hunters. And of course, it takes a large group to bring down even a medium-sized elephant. So this is one of the biggest groups of lions in Africa, one of the biggest prides in Africa. And the team were waiting there for nightfall because, of course, the lions attack by night, and there's a simple reason for that, which is lions have excellent night vision, and elephants really have no better vision at night than we do. In order to see them, the camera team had an infrared camera and infrared lights. Now, when these lights are switched on, no one can see them, not the crew, not the elephants, and not the lions. But by looking down the eyepiece of the infrared camera, the camera woman, Justine, could see absolutely everything. So we have this extraordinary scene where lions are particularly actually trying to get the calves, but in doing so, absolutely terrifying the adult elephants and chasing the elephants around the waterhole. And actually, it's one of the most dangerous things that we filmed for Earth, because whilst many people might think that these lions could leap into the back of the vehicle and take the camera crew, in fact, they just don't register a vehicle as being prey. You could say that they're not particularly bright, but they don't recognise the opportunity that's in front of them. The real danger lies in the fact that they are terrifying elephants, and a terrified elephant is quite a formidable thing, and many Land Rovers in the past in Africa have been flattened by rampaging elephants, and that's in the daytime. So of course you've got a crew sitting around a waterhole with elephants rampaging past them, terrified, being chased by lions, and the elephants don't even know where the vehicle is. So there's a large element of luck required just in order not to get crushed.
So did any of the camera crew get hurt by the elephants?
No, none of them. I'm pleased to say that they were all absolutely fine, but quite shaken by you know what they saw. And this was quite an interesting challenge for Alistair and I. We had to think very carefully about what things to include in Earth, because we didn't want to shy away from the fact that animals eat and are eaten, but at the same time we didn't want to show any what we felt was gratuitous blood and violence, because A, we didn't feel it's particularly interesting. You know, the interesting part is the strategy of the hunt. It's not seeing an animal torn apart in detail. So we didn't really see that stuff was interesting. And furthermore, it was very important to us that we made a movie that we felt children could see and that parents felt safe taking their children to.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much in Earth for young children, and we felt so passionately that we wanted young people to be able to see the movie that we discussed, you know, at great length where the line should be drawn on these predation sequences. And you know, generally the strategy is interesting, the strategy of the predator is interesting, the strategy of the prey to escape is interesting, but once you get to the moment where the outcome is really self-evident, we felt it was right to cut the camera at that point.
Well, for example, in the sequence where the lions are attacking the elephants, you see a lion basically jump up and bite an elephant a couple of times. So you don't see the final kill, but you see elements of the attack.
Well, that's precisely it. I mean, the lions mount the elephant, and very conveniently the elephant runs behind a bush where the lions dispatch it. And you might say that's a slightly Disney ending, you know, you don't get to see the meat of it. You know, we would say that was exactly the right point to cut, because the interesting part, the rare piece of behaviour, had been seen by that point. And really we had plenty of material of what followed, and I have to tell you the rushes were, or the dailies as you call them, were quite hard to stomach, some of them, and we just saw really no benefit in showing that to people.
So since you spend so much time in the wild shooting animals, do you have pets to go home to?
Yeah, I have a cat. I have to say Alice is not very happy about that, because my cat eats birds and Alice is extremely keen on birds.
I love birds.
But no, I like as many animals in my life as possible. And I'm very fond of my cat.
Do you see your cat differently because you see so many like lions and cheetahs and?
No, I see my cat for the awful little predator that it is. but I'm in complete denial here, but I mistakenly think that he recognises me and loves me. I'm sure he doesn't. But no, he is part of the natural world, just like all of us, and he is a ruthless little predator.
And I have a couple of Jack Russell dogs, and my boys have hamsters, Siberian hamsters, which they love. And, no, good pets, they're good fun.
All right. Well, thank you both so much, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you very much. Very nice to have such a nice chat.
Alistair Fothergill and Mark Linfield directed the movie Earth. We spoke in April when the film was released. Our Animal Week series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Animal Week series continues with an animal that has a perverse celebrity status, the rat. Journalist Robert Sullivan describes rats as nature's mobsters, flora and fauna's serial killers who breed in filth and carry disease. They're all around us, even if they're hiding out of our sight. It wasn't difficult for Robert Sullivan to find a colony of rats to study. He chose a trash-filled alley just a block or two from Wall Street. He waited night after night to watch the rats come out and feed. After also traveling with exterminators and doing historical research, he wrote his book Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. This interview was recorded with Sullivan in 2004 when the book was published. We started with a short reading from Sullivan's Rat Journal describing one evening in his rat alley.
6:50. Out across Fulton Street, the garbage from the Burger King is dragged out, as I imagine is happening at fast food restaurants all over New York and around this time. A small mountain of garbage bags forms, a vile and grease-dripping, sedimentary New York City occurrence that nightly turns the streets into miniature badlands to be eroded by morning, assuming the sanitation workers arrive, after which there will be dark stains on the concrete, like sweat on the morning rocks of a mountain. 6:57. More garbage, more rats. So many more that it's becoming difficult to concentrate. There are too many rats now, more than a dozen visible at any time. Squads constantly surfacing, resurfacing. In the foreground are the young rats. In the back, the larger rats. The rats that must be older, given their size. When I venture up with binoculars, I can see their mottled coats, the bite marks. On one, a gash-like scar. I see also specialty diversions, rat performers in a circus of trash, affording much entertainment for the alley watcher. A rat climbs up a garbage bag, stops at the summit, appears to look around. The rat jumps nearly straight up, in fact, jumps for what my later measurements will show to be 1 foot, up, up, and onto the old ledge of a boarded-up window. The rat walks along the ledge and turns behind the rusted old steel window bars to face the alley again, then lowers himself down onto a bag back close to the wall, a bag that is inaccessible from the alley floor. 7:15. The rats are drunk on food, I think. Technically speaking, all a rat needs is 3 to 4 ounces of food a day, but these rats seem to be greatly exceeding that amount. And wouldn't you? It's not at all difficult to picture the rat eating at its food source until the food source is destroyed, cleaned out, until the rat must move on to the next alley, the next street, the next neighborhood.
That's Robert Sullivan reading from his new book, Rats. Robert, why did you want to spend a year observing rats in a New York alley?
I feel like saying it wasn't my fault. I didn't mean to do it. Sometimes I don't know why at all, and other times it seems I can't believe I wasn't doing it sooner. I like to go places where rats tend to be, and you know, alleys and swamps and garbage dumps, all the places that nobody wants to go to. It turns out that rats are kind of the theme park mascot of of my places that I like. But the other thing happened was I was writing a book about a whale hunt, about a tribe, Native American tribe, and they were hunting a whale. And everybody, of course, came up to say you can't hunt a whale. The tribe said we should be able to, maybe. And some people said you should. It was a big to-do about whales. And I started reading about whales and why we kind of love whales. And I read about how we went from being a whaling nation and whaling, you know, the whales out of the world pretty much, to being a nation that kind of loves whales, loves dolphins, especially loves dolphins. And we feel we're on a parallel. Sometimes some people think we can communicate with dolphins. We're like dolphins. And then I started thinking, well, what's the creature that nobody feels like they can think like? The creature that nobody wants to say, I went swimming with rats tonight, you know, in a lagoon in Florida. And that ends up being rats. So this is the creature that I want to check out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how did you choose your spot to observe rats?
Well, I have a friend from high school, my friend Dave, and we still hang out even since high school, and we decided to kind of go out looking for the perfect place to look for rats. Of course, we asked our wives if it's all right if we went out after dinner to look for rats. And my wife said that would be fine as long as I went with Dave. It's very important to her that I'm with somebody when I'm out there looking at rats. Although, after a while, I was going alone. I got to know my alley. But we just kind of went into downtown Manhattan at night. I'd gotten some tips from some exterminators that around the seaport would be a good area. First, we found this abandoned McDonald's. It was kind of filled with rats. What was amazing was, initially, we looked in the McDonald's. We went by it maybe a couple times that night, or we looked in it at first and saw nothing. But then we went back, and we realized it was filled with rats. We just didn't know how to see them. And this is an exciting thing you learned early on, is that there's all this stuff going on in places that you don't know stuff is going on. You can't see rats. That doesn't mean they're not there. Anyway, we ended up going beyond that, to this little alley that was kind of between two restaurants, and it was just, we realized, really full of rats. And moreover, there was this great kind of multicultural food supply. And finally, this was just a great small alley that I felt like I'd maybe seen once but hadn't seen. People were walking by it and not noticing it, and that felt like the perfect place, a place that everybody passed by and nobody saw.
Now, rats are nocturnal animals. When do they start coming out?
They come out on cue. It's amazing. They come out right after the sunset, just before it gets dark. They come out first, and they do an initial feeding. As I'm saying this, I can't believe that this really happens, but it really happens. They kind of get an initial, you know, run through. It's sort of like breakfast. Then if it's a heavy alley, an alley with a lot of garbage, you'll see them continue to be out. But they'll go back into their nests. And in this particular alley, that meant that they would sometimes go back down through the cracks in the cobblestones, back down into the street, into the hill, which was very, very amazing. But anyway, then they'll come out again kind of in the middle of the night, and they'll oftentimes come out for another big feeding before sunset. It's the reverse of our day.
I always associate rats with garbage. Do rats have a preference for food that's rotting? Or if we left like fresh food out for them, would they be eating that as much as the garbage?
Well, rats like garbage, but there's different kinds of garbage. And many people think of garbage rightfully as garbage. But if you take apart garbage, you see that, there's all different parts to it. And rats won't eat rancid food. They won't go for stale or bad food necessarily. They'll take what they like first. And I think it's written in the rat literature that a rat might starve in an alley full of raw carrots. Rats, generally speaking, are not crazy about their vegetables. They like fried foods. They like fatty foods. A really fun thing about the rat food preference list is that it matched up very nicely with the human food preference list. And, you know, like a gourmet magazine, I could just see a rat sitting down saying, oh, yeah, I got to make that out of last week's garbage. And another interesting thing about rat food and garbage is that rats develop kind of a preference, a palate that matches the neighborhood. And I'd sort of heard this. I'd heard from exterminators who'd said that, my rats like this kind of spicy food and my rats like this kind of food. And it's pretty interesting to think that a rat would develop an interest in the food that matched the culture, the ethnicity that lived in that neighborhood.
So what was like the creepiest or scariest moment for you when you were in the alley that you adopted observing the rats?
There were many creepy, disturbing moments. But the most sort of rat-oriented, rat-freaky moment definitely happened to be when I was in this one alley with my friend Dave and another friend Matt, and I had to kind of turn away people from going ratting with me. Oftentimes people would say, you know, could I go to your rat alley? And that's the kind of thing, you can't let everybody go to your rat alley. It gets out of hand. So at one point I did, though, bring a second friend when we were thinking about maybe trapping rats and so forth. Something that didn't work out the way I'd hoped. Anyway, Matt and Dave were in the alley, and there was a guy named Derek who was kind of living around the alley, and he seemed to have some control over the rats in this alley. And this was another alley from my alley, but it was definitely a rat-filled alley. And he orchestrated the movement of the rats, Derek did. And Derek began calling upon the rats and beating with a stick and beating metal, and the rats then started running out all at once. And we went over the numbers immediately after. Dave and Matt and I went over the numbers, and there were definitely, we want to say thousands of rats, but there weren't. There were somewhere between 100 and 200 rats. There were a lot of rats, and they were all coming down the alley. This is a tough thing to experience if you're just a person in sneakers and light camping gear. And here comes this pack of rats, which, of course, I'd read about, you know, many times but never seen. And the pack of rats is coming. And what was most amazing was as soon as they hit this corner, corner of an old abandoned building, they all took a left. And it was just like watching everybody come off of Lexington Avenue and sneak into that small subway entrance that's around 59th or 58th. Everybody went down a single file. It went from crazed mass pack of rats to single file. Okay, around the corner, we're going down this hole now. It was incredible.
Well, Robert, now that this book is behind you, I wish you a life without rats.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for talking with us.
I wish you a life without rats as well. Thank you.
Robert Sullivan recorded in 2004 after the publication of his book, Rats. Underneath the cow patties in the pasture and the monkey dung in the jungle, there's a miniature world of sex and violence. Dung beetles with fierce-looking horns are battling over female beetles, and my guest Doug Emlyn is studying them. He's an expert on the evolution and development of bizarre or extreme shapes in insects. He's particularly interested in insect weaponry. Dung beetles have what he's looking for. Lots of his work is in the lab, but he's also had some wild adventures collecting different families of dung beetles from around the world. Emlyn is a professor of biology at the University of Montana. If you want to follow along on our website, there's a dung beetle slideshow and a video of two beetles battling. That's at freshair.npr.org. Doug Emlyn, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I think it's fair to say that dung beetles wouldn't be most people's first choice of an animal to study. So what is unique about the dung beetle's armor that makes you so interested in studying them?
There are a variety of things, and I guess I should first of all qualify that by saying they weren't my first choice of organism either. It's a hard thing to wake up in the morning and decide you're suddenly going to go out there and study dung beetles. I started out trying to study some of the big rhinoceros beetles as a graduate student, and the project failed pretty spectacularly, and it was a biologist named Bill Eberhard that took me under his wing after that failed project and said, no, you're looking at the wrong beetles. And he opened up this box, and it was full of all these little tiny beetles that are the size of your pinky or even the size of an eraser on a new pencil. And he opens up the box and it smells like horse manure. And I looked at him and I said, those are dung beetles. There's no way I'm going to work on those things. And he laughed at me at the time and told me I was a fool and basically explained that for all the kinds of biology that I wanted to understand, genetics and behavior and diversity, these things were perfect. And since that time, to come back full circle to your question, the dung beetles have turned out to be an amazing system to study, and they've taught us so much about biology in many ways. But you mentioned the weapons. The thing that first drew me to them is the spectacular diversity in their morphology. They have these incredible shapes, and most of the diversity in those shapes involves these weapons. And so for lack of a better analogy, these tiny little insects that, again, as I said, are often the size of an eraser on a pencil, on a new pencil, these things are the insect equivalent of a bull elk or a major male deer, and they have incredible weapons coming off of their bodies. And you look across the species, and there's variation among the species. Sometimes the horns come from the back of the head, sometimes from the front of the head, sometimes from the thorax, which is equivalent to sort of between your shoulder blades. Sometimes they're branched, forked, curved, straight. There's just an incredible variety of forms. And I was interested as a biologist in how a little tiny animal like that could strut around with these enormous weapons sticking off the side of their body and survive.
Yeah, well, it's kind of amazing. And, I mean, not only do they have these weapons, like some of them are like antlers, some of them are like a rhinoceros horn, some of them are like lobster pincers, but they also have like hair.
Many of the horns, you mean the beetles or the horns?
Well, the beetles, and yeah.
They do, and some of the horns in some of the species tend to have hair. We see that more often in the rhinoceros beetles than in the dung beetles per se, but very often the sides of these horns are adorned with thick rows of hairs. And it's really sort of embarrassingly unknown what those things do. There's a good chance that they are sensory structures so that when a male locks with another male fighting, they can tell where the horns of the opponent male are because they're distending or pushing down all these fine hairs on the surface of the horn. But some people think that the hairs might actually have chemodetectors. They may be good for smell or for releasing signals. We don't know.
I can tell you one thing for sure. They're not fashionable. They're really creepy looking.
That's a matter of opinion. I disagree. I think they're fantastic.
Well, they are fantastic in a creepy kind of way. Let me ask you to describe one or two of the types of dung beetles that you find most fascinating in terms of their form and shape.
Sure. So one of the species of dung beetle that we've spent quite a bit of time studying has the species name Taurus, as in the bull, and it actually has a pair of long curved horns that extend upwards and backwards from the head of male beetles. So it's a big curled set of horns, and when the head is tucked back against the rest of the body, the horns sort of wrap in snugly around the equivalent of the shoulders or the thorax. But when these males are fighting, they pull their heads forward, and they've got quite an impressive pair of horns.
So the purpose of these weapons, you know, the horns and the pincers, are basically to fight off other guys for girls. It's like the male dung beetles fight each other over the available female beetles.
They do.
Have you watched them fight?
Oh, yes. Yes, many times.
Oh, describe what a fight looks like.
That actually looks like pandemonium. It was not what we expected at all. So these are dung beetles, the ones that we're talking about right now. And so what happens in these cases is these beetles are very good at smelling their food source, and they follow these odor cues into the food. And when they find dung of the particular species that they feed on, they often have to deal with hundreds and in some cases thousands of other individuals that are coming in and piling into that same place and basically competing to carve up and use that food resource. So what happens is the beetles go instantly underground. They go right beneath the food source, the dung pile, so to speak, and the females actually excavate these burrows in the ground. And the males guard the entrances to these burrows, and they have big teeth-like spines on their legs, and they lock themselves, they brace themselves against the tunnel walls and try to prevent rival males from getting into the tunnels where the females are. The females, these are amazing insects because they have elaborate parental care behaviors. The females will take pieces of the dung down into the burrows and chew them up with their mouth parts and process them and pack them together into these sort of balls, these little sausages of buried dung underground. And then she'll excavate a chamber at the end of that and place an egg in there. And that's essentially the full food resource, like an aliquot of food for each one of her offspring. And she'll do that, lay an egg and then close in the tunnel and then build another one of these balls and then close the tunnel. And we've watched these beetles do this. The females will make 50-100 different trips down into the ground for every single one of these eggs that she lays. And during this time, the male is guarding that tunnel, keeping everybody else away, and mating with the female absolutely as often as he possibly can. And other males come and challenge. And the fights take place inside these tunnels. And they scramble and they push and they pry and they twist. And we tried forever to figure out how it is exactly that they use these horns. Because we wanted to know, why would one species have a straight horn and another species have a curved horn and another species have a branched horn? And we were assuming that we'd be able to pick up intricacies in the nature of these fights that would tell us why one species had one shape or another. And we failed. The fights are just chaos. We filmed hundreds of them. And they're amazing things to watch, but there's nothing predictable or repeatable about them except the outcome. Somehow or other, bracing and twisting and prying and pushing and pulling and trying to get the other beetle out of the tunnel, somehow at the end of the day, the male that has the longest horns and or the largest body sizes typically is the one who wins. And the smaller males get pushed out of the tunnels and leave and go find another tunnel and try to push their way into that.
So they just use these horns to bash away at their competition?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it bash. I would say they more use the horns to block the tunnel. You've got essentially a round or an egg-shaped animal blocking a tunnel, and they're very strong. So you have a rival pushing itself past, and it seems that the horns, regardless of what precise shape they take, seem to function like bars of a jail cell. They sort of block, they make it easier for a male inside the tunnel to block it so that another male can't push past. But it's not as simple as that because they don't sit still. They twist and push and pry. But they don't stab with them. They aren't able to puncture the armor of the rival males, so they don't actually get injured in this process. And they don't really bash each other either, but they definitely spar and twist, sort of strength contests, I suppose. But there's a twist to this story, too.
Yeah.
Which is that the biggest males have the biggest weapons, and these are the ones that are usually the most successful at guarding that tunnel and at mating with the female inside the tunnel, but there's small males in these populations, too. And they don't produce the horns. And so these small males look much more similar to a female. They don't have the big antlers or the big weapons, and they don't fight over the tunnels either. They have a sneak tactic, a satellite tactic. What'll happen is they'll work their way into a tunnel and try to stay there, but they get kicked out right away by bigger males. And instead of going from tunnel to tunnel to tunnel to keep trying, they stay after they get kicked out, and they dig their own tunnel right next to the main tunnel. And after they get sort of a centimeter or so down below the ground, they cut horizontally and they can intercept the guarded tunnel beneath the guarding male. And sometimes they're able to sneak in, zoom down to the female, mate with the female, and get out again before the guarding male has essentially figured out what's going on. So you've got big males with weapons fighting and little tiny sneak males without the weapons sneaking into these tunnels on the sly.
My guest is biologist Doug Emlin. We'll talk more about studying dung beetles after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is biologist Doug Emlin. We're talking about what he's learned studying dung beetles and their bizarre world of armed battle under animal manure. Now, you've described these, like, you know, antler-like and branch-like weapons, you know, armor and weapons that the dung beetles have. And they sound like really big compared to the size of the actual beetles. Aren't they kind of cumbersome to tote around? I mean, I know they need them to fight and to bar off the tunnels and prevent other males from getting in, but they must also really get in the way.
They do. And so to try to give you a sense for how much they get in the way, the analogy I like to use is that for some of these beetles, it would be equivalent to you producing another leg and wearing it around on your head for your entire adult life.
Wow.
That's the best analogy I can give you because if you try to estimate how big these things are, in some of these cases, the horn, the weapons, can be 10, 15, 20% of the body weight of the animal. It's a fifth of the total weight of the animal is allocated to this one thing. And so it really is analogous to an extra leg on your head for your entire adult life. And it has to be costly. So we've used a variety of types of experiments to try to measure how costly it is. And we found, for example, if a male beetle puts a ton of resources into making a horn, it means that he has to stunt something else. There's not enough resources left, in a sense. And so in some of these beetles, if they have really big horns, they have really small eyes. We found that in beetles that have horns on the back of their head, their eyes were 30% smaller as a result of having allocated everything to the weapons. And in other species, they actually trade off with the testes or with the wings. So there are costs associated with producing these big, bulky things.
So what do these dung beetles say about evolution? What do you feel like you've learned about evolution from studying them?
The biggest question that I have been focusing on and that I think I've learned a ton from these beetles on has to do with the backdrop of animal diversity. It's very hard to be an evolutionary biologist and not look around you and become sort of increasingly aware of the differences among animals that are out there. The variation in shape, especially connected with these weapons, is truly stunning in this group of beetles. And so as a biologist, I'm obsessed with understanding where this diversity in form comes from. How did these big, gaudy structures arise? Meaning, what did the beetles use these for? How are, you know, once we know how they're used in natural populations, we can ask questions like, how did they evolve? Under what types of ecological or environmental circumstances are these weapons likely to evolve? And then that leads us to the next question of, why don't all these beetles have the same weapons? What is it about them or about their history or the ecologies and behaviors of these animals in the past that has caused weapon evolution to go one way in some populations and a different way in other populations, and for it to go in enough different ways in enough different species that we end up with the truly thousands of types of shapes and forms and locations for these weapons on their bodies? And so there's sort of fundamental biological questions connected with animal diversity that we are tackling with these beetles.
Well, Doug Emlen, thank you so much for talking with us about the beetles that you've been studying.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure too.
Doug Emlen is a professor of biology at the University of Montana. Our interview was recorded last May. If you'd like to see a dung beetle slideshow and a video of two beetles battling, go to our website at freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. Suze Boland directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.